We're going to change gears a little bit because we're going to look now at, speaking of physics and science and all kinds of stuff, at two famous scientists we don't often think about, Albert Einstein and Sigmund Freud. They worked in two different worlds, one, of course, in the cosmos, the other in the unconscious or the subconscious. And scientifically, they seem to have very little in common. But as they say, timing is everything, because both Freud and Einstein came of age in a time when many scientists believed that we had reached the end of what we could learn about the natural world. What was needed, though no one knew it, was a different way of looking at the world. And in their own ways, Freud and Einstein, they did just that. Joining me now to talk about more about these two scientists and their lives and times is Richard Panik. He's written for the New York Times and Natural History Magazine. He's author of Seeing and Believing, How the Telescope Opened Our Eyes and Minds to the Heavens. His new book is The Invisible Century, Einstein, Freud, and the Search for Hidden Universes, published by Viking. And he joins us from WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Panik.
Not Dr. Panik. I don't have a background in science. I have a background in writing and journalism. But thank you.
That's what they call me doctor. I say my mother loves you, but no, thank you.
I don't even get to play one on radio. You know?
We'll call you if you like. That's why I'm offering it. You start your book with a description of a meeting of Einstein and Freud. Tell us about that meeting. Were they good friends?
No. They certainly knew of each other. They were the two, I think, probably the two most famous scientists at the time. And this was in January of 1927, very early January, during the holiday season still. Mm-hmm. And Einstein was in Berlin, and he paid a call on Freud, who was staying at the house of his one of his sons. And they just spent an evening together. And afterwards, a few days, actually just within the same month, somebody approached Einstein about the idea of being psychoanalyzed, and he said, no, I would prefer to remain in the darkness. And just a couple of days after the meeting, Freud wrote to a friend that he had spent the evening with Einstein, and Einstein, he said, understands as much about psychology as I do about physics, and therefore we passed a very pleasant evening.
But in your book, you write that that Freud was jealous of Einstein.
Yes, he was. Einstein, from Freud's point of view, had it a lot easier. You mentioned a few minutes ago that at the end of the 19th century, people were wondering if science had run its course, if mm-hmm. the whole Newtonian empirical method of doing science had reached its limits, both looking outward through telescopes and inward through microscopes. Einstein had that tradition to build on. Freud, from his point of view, didn't. When Freud went into the unconscious, he saw himself as blazing a trail that where nobody else had ever gone. Certainly people had been talking about psychology, and there had been rumblings of the unconscious throughout the 19th century, but Freud was the first one who tried to make a science out of it. And in making a science out of it, he felt that he was running at a disadvantage to somebody like Einstein.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking with Richard Panik, author of The Invisible Century, Einstein, Freud, and the Search for Hidden Universes. Of course, you say that no one believed that psychology really was a science. You didn't have experiments you could prove as you could in physics.
That's right. And people still to this day, of course, are debating whether Freud's methodology passes the scientific smell test. But I think that, and I argue in the book, that Freud was actually building on the tradition of Darwin, which is, you collect a lot of facts, and in that way, it's like the old inductive reasoning. You put a lot mm-hmm. of facts together and then you come to a conclusion. But the conclusions that they were coming to were not about predictability in the way that physics is, where in physics you say if a planet is at this point in its orbit on July 30th, 2004, it will be there on a future date. Darwin and then Freud were using more of a postdictive method. They were saying, here's how we got to this point. If we use these principles, if we use natural selection, if we use the unconscious, we can go back and trace how we reached this point. But basically, in both the individual, which is what Freud was dealing with, or with a collection of individuals, a species, which is what Darwin was dealing with, there are so many variables that any kind of predictability is really out of the question.
Mm-hmm. And as the central theme of your book, you're saying that they're forced to look for evidence that no one can see.
Right. After these two or three centuries of the scientific method, as it was then practiced and known, As I said earlier, people were looking through telescopes. They were looking through microscopes. They were reaching the limits of what they could find. And in the book, I tried to go back and say, well, what, you know, Einstein and Freud weren't out to remake science. They were trying to do science to the best of their abilities, the way that they knew how. And at a certain point, they simply ran out of empirical evidence. And at that point, they had to make a leap into the unknown, into the invisible, which is, you know, what I, which is why the book is called The Invisible Century. And in doing so, they had to posit that there were these that there were these other things out there, that there were relativistic effects in Einstein's case, that, you know, the slowing of time, which you couldn't observe, but you could work it out mathematically and therefore take it seriously. And in Freud's case, dealing with the unconscious, you can, he felt you can build a theory around that, you know, and what we would come and what we would call today the science of psychoanalysis, or not, or the, or you might call not the science of psychoanalysis.
Yes, it's losing favor in certain places now. We're going to take a break before we get into another question. I have to rudely interrupt. So we're going to take a break and come back and talk a lot more with Richard Panik, author of The Invisible Century, Einstein, Freud, and the Search for Hidden Universes. Take your calls. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Get on the phone and talk with Richard and join the conversation. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the history of science this hour, turning the clock back 100 years, talking with Richard Panik, author of The Invisible Century, Einstein, Freud, and the Search for Hidden Universes. Our number 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about comparing physics and psychology, and one of the things that you mentioned in your book is that in terms of how Freud compared himself to Einstein as a physicist, he talked about Einstein at least had all of history behind him. He stood on the shoulders of other physicists, on the shoulders of giants, and Freud had to start everything over again, didn't he?
Yeah, I think, and that was a source of frustration. I mean, he always felt that, as I said earlier, that he was working at a disadvantage when Einstein, though, admired Freud. He didn't fully believe that Freud was working in scientific way that, you know, as Einstein understood it. He wasn't quite sure about the unconscious, but he admired Freud very much as a writer. To Freud, this felt a little patronizing, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah.
In the early 1930s, when a division of the League of Nations invited Einstein to write about war, and they said, why don't you have a correspondence with another major scientist, Einstein immediately turned to Freud, and Freud accepted, but a little unwillingly, or a little reluctantly, I should say. He felt that it was a bit of a chore, and in fact, Einstein, in his letter, talked about the mass psychosis of, you know, of that leads up to war and unconscious influences and so on. And Freud basically responded graciously, but more or less said in his opening paragraph, there's very little left for me to say, because Einstein had appropriated his language.
If Darwin had come a little later, could you have included him as part of a trio here of people who started and look, you know, for Hidden Universes?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And sometimes people do. I think that there was a special issue of U.S. News and World Report a year or two ago that had the three of them on the cover. But I think that if Darwin was the antecedent of Freud, in the same way Einstein looked back to James Clerk Maxwell, who in the middle of the 19th century was working out the equations for electromagnetic theory and the whole idea that electricity and magnetism put them together and they become light.
Right.
You know, and in order to understand that, he was talking about fields, which was a new concept, and just as invisible as what Einstein would be working with later. That was certainly one giant who whose shoulders Einstein was standing on. In the same way, I think that, you know, Freud, you know, maybe should have recognized. I mean, he admired Darwin very much, but I think he maybe could have recognized better that he was standing on Darwin's shoulders.
Yeah, he came very shortly after. He started the university 14 years after Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, 2 years after he wrote The Descent of Man.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And in fact, one of his professors, one of Freud's professors at the University of Vienna, Karl Klaus, had just, when he came to the university, he had just, in fact, met with Darwin. He had, on his way to the university, he took a detour north, visited Darwin in England, and then immediately came in, you know, to spread the gospel of Darwinism.
1-800
That was Freud in his first class.
I'm sorry. 1-800-989-8255. Hope in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
My comment was just, as a future psychologist, I studied psychology for a long time, and I also happen to be a huge fan of Einstein and Darwin, and I think that Freud, his theories aren't set up very empirically, and when you look at other psychologists who are really blazing their own trails, like Pavlov and Watson in the behavioral movement, you know, their theories were really set up so that you can prove or disprove them, just like Darwin and Einstein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think that Freud would have disagreed. I think that he felt that what he was seeing in his office and what other analysts could see as clinicians, as dealing with their patients, they could put together the kind of information over a period of many years that Darwin put together over a period of many years before finally publishing on The Origin of Species. You know, and again, this is a debate that goes on. And one of the points that I try to make in the book is that, in fact, the Einsteinian way of doing science, which was a departure from the past, in that he said, you know, I can say that there is evidence out there because I can show it mathematically, and then we should go out and find it, which is kind of a reversal of the way things had been going. In the same way, I think Freud was, has become the foremost, you know, example mm-hmm. of the other way that science went in the 20th century, or tried to go in the 20th century, the soft sciences, you know, and they actually became in the 1920s, 1930s, Einstein and Freud, became in philosophical circles, really the example of the way to do science and the way not to do science.
It's interesting that that whole period, the turn of the century there, everybody was looking for the invisible stuff. I mean, here you had Einstein working with ether, trying to find mm-hmm. that with famous experiments. You had Freud and consciousness. You had Rankin and the X-rays, right? It was about the time people first looking visibly through your hands.
That's right. And that, you know, we mentioned Maxwell a few minutes ago and his equations, the field equations for electromagnetism in the middle 19th century. The idea of radio, speaking of radio, since Ryan, radio waves, radio waves were discovered in the late 1880s, specifically because people were looking for them, because they now had the equations. And they said, okay, let's go out and look for these. When Rankin discovered X-rays in late 1895 and then published his results in early 1896, there was a great deal of debate about whether or not these were forms of electromagnetism, if they were, you know, light rays, but at a different level. Radio waves are very long, and there was some speculation as to whether X-rays are actually very short in wavelengths. Right. And that is, in fact, what they turned out to be. And I think, to a certain extent, if I can tell an anecdote, the genesis of this book came about actually while I was sitting in on jury duty. I was on a grand jury, which allows you to take notes in and reading material. And I was sitting there thinking about, you mentioned earlier that my previous book was Seeing and Believing, which is a history of the telescope. And when you get into the 20th century, it turns out that there are all these other forms of light out there, radio, X-ray, infrared, and so on. And it just opens up the universe in a whole new way. And I was thinking about X-rays and how they have come about and proved a lot of Einstein's ideas. You were just talking about black holes in the mm-hmm. previous segment, or the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of these ideas really come out of Einstein's theories, and X-rays help to validate them. At the same time, I was in psychoanalysis, and I had developed a shorthand with my analyst where I would refer to being able to, like, discern the motives behind people's behavior that they're not aware of, and I would say it's like having X-ray vision. And so I was sitting in jury duty, and I kind of went, "Oh, X-ray vision and X-ray astronomy." And then I had the whole idea of Einstein and Freud being at the forefront. But I felt that, in a way, this experience of of Röntgen's discovery of X-rays must have informed the culture at that time and made the idea of the invisible more palatable.
Sure, because everybody would like to put their feet in those fluoroscopes.
Right, exactly.
See, yeah, now we could look inside stuff that we couldn't see. We can understand. The scientists were also seeking, and they are still seeking, to take religion out of the mystery here. Did Freud seek that also?
Yeah. I mean, they both did. I mean, Einstein would occasionally refer to, the Lord does not, or subtle is the Lord,
right.
God doesn't play dice with the universe, and so on. But his God was not, this father figure in the sky kind of God. It was more sense of nature, that nature doesn't do this. Freud, on the other hand, felt that religion was he wrote about it in The Future of an Illusion, right? I mean, that was all about, it was almost a Marxist view that it was a corruption. It was a way of influencing the species, if you will.
Yeah. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones. James in St. Louis. Hi, James.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello.
I've recently been reading some books about Jung, and a lot of the criticisms that Jung, faced and still faces seem to me they kind of apply to Freud as well. Freud, he was right out there on the edge at the beginning of the creation of this whole new school of study, but he didn't have a lot of data to work with, and his data set was extremely narrow. And he kind of reminds me of some of these philosopher scientists of ancient Greece, where they have a little evidence, and then they make these gigantic, sweeping predictions and theories about the universe, and don't seem to go back and test new data against them. And, as we've moved forward in psychology and psychiatry, it seems to me that almost all of Freud's larger predictions have been either completely discounted or called into question, yet Freud remains this towering figure that people still refer to as a source of authority, even though as a scientist, although he may be interesting or important as a pioneer, most of his actual theories have been pushed aside by more recent scholarship.
Right. And in fact, in the book, I don't deal much with his later work. What I tried to do in the book, on both sides, on Einstein and Freud, was say what were the issues that they were dealing with. Ira alluded earlier to Einstein dealing with the idea of the ether, that the atmosphere, that all of space has this kind of background. It serves as an absolute space, in effect. And Einstein got rid of the ether. But Einstein, as in his early years, sought the ether as much as any other scientist. It's what physicists did. Freud, on the same, I think in the same way, he started out as a neurologist, and I spend a lot of the book dealing with that as a neuroanatomist and a neurophysiologist. And he was looking at some point, or was aware of and was looking for the neuron, what we would now call the neuron, which was the ultimate connection within the circuitry of the brain between one central brain cell and another. People couldn't find it. They had been looking for it for a long time. And finally, in the late 1880s, it was discovered that in fact, the tentacles out of one central cell in the brain don't connect with the tentacles from another central nerve cell, but an electrical charge of some sort crosses them and they come together and then they withdraw. So they actually found this ultimate point of contact from between one nerve cell and the other, unlike Einstein, who couldn't find the ether because it didn't exist. On Freud's side, they did find it, but that still couldn't account for what he was seeing in his waiting room or in his clinic. And for that, he had to come up with the idea of the unconscious. And I agree with the listener from St. Louis who said that a lot of Freud's later work was highly speculative and really open to argument. But I think that the reason why he endures as a towering figure, as the listener said, is that he came up with this idea of the unconscious and really implanted it in our awareness. He took what had been, I mean, you know, he said, look, I'm not dealing with anything that artists and writers haven't dealt with forever. But he took that idea and he raised it from the subtext into the text. So it was something that we thought about and recognized as existing. And that's a whole different idea from just saying that there are things out there that we're not aware of. And I think that was his contribution.
Yeah. Talking with Richard Panik, author of The Invisible Century, Einstein, Freud, and the Search for Hidden Universes, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. So you think he'll be remembered for bringing the, you know, we may not remember him for, you know, for psychoanalysis and where it's headed and the techniques, but we will remember him for making us conscious of the of consciousness.
Of the unconscious.
Of the unconscious.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. I think so. I mean, psychoanalysis might endure. It's being adapted. There's now a movement called neuropsychoanalysis, which is really going back to the kind of work that Freud was doing in the early 1890s, which is trying to map the circuitry of the brain, except now we have more sophisticated means for doing it. We have MRIs and so on. And they're trying to find, and they're actually finding, I mean, this is a matter of great debate, of course, but they're finding, or at least some people are saying that they're finding the kind of circuitry that would actually show why the unconscious works the way it does, thoughts or the lighting up of the brain kind of leaps around certain sections of the brain, and in a way that we would expect to be the case in the unconscious, where things are still present, but they're absent at the same time, and yet they're active at the same time.
And it seems like, you know, you mentioned Freud started out by looking at neurons, and the circle has come full now because that's where the research is back again, still looking at those neurons.
Right, right, right.
But he just didn't have the tools and the techniques, I guess. You know, so he had to look at the invisible stuff that he could deal with. They didn't have the tools for dissecting or imaging neurons like we have today.
Right. And even if they had, I think that he still would have said that there was something missing there. I mean, his approach was appropriately for his time, purely physiological from the 1870s when he was entering university to the middle of the 1890s. He was really struggling with that circuitry of the brain. And at some point he just said, you know, it's not about the brain, or it is about the brain, but I can't take it there. And he always said actually that eventually his ideas would come down to chemical and biological components. So that's exactly what you're saying, like,
right,
with the studies today.
Yeah, and did he have any friends he could bounce ideas off? You know, today you have all these physicists. Einstein had a whole circle of physicists he could deal with. Was he just so alone as a pioneer in this that he really, you know, there were very few people around that he could say, hey, this might work, this might not work?
He had one great friend. Well, of course, he did studies on hysteria with Joseph Breuer, but they had a falling out, which is typically the case with Freud, actually. Mm-hmm. But during this formative period that we're talking about, when he makes the leap into the unconscious, when he goes from brain to mind, he was bouncing ideas off a crackpot, really. His name was Wilhelm Fleiss. Or Fleiss, actually, I'm sorry.
It's a fitting name, I guess.
yes. And he really was a crackpot. And Freud, you know, Freud was casting about, and Freud backed him up, and you know, books have been written about this, God knows. And it was, it was a very embarrassing period. And it was a prolonged period. I realized lately that people sometimes, when they speak about the mishaps of Freud and his credulity in certain areas, that they often talk about it as if it were an isolated instance. And I think it really does him a disservice. And, I guess it's understandable, but I was thinking about what people refer to as the cocaine episode.
Right.
It wasn't an episode. It went on for a while, you know. Yeah. And in the same way, his relationship with Fleiss went on for many years. And eventually they parted ways right around the time that Freud was beginning to become famous, and whether or not that was a factor, I can't say.
But. Richard Panik, I want to thank you very much. Very interesting book.
Oh, thank you.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
The Invisible Century, Einstein, Freud, and the Search for Hidden Universes, and a good read about Einstein and Freud. And thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
We're going to take a break and come back and talk about a new experiment that might upset quantum mechanics. So we've been talking about quantum today. Interesting experiment. It's just being published. You can actually see a copy of it in the New Scientist magazine. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Talk about it.